Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the latest Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I am here today with Richard Kreitner and to talk about his brand new book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, published just last month by Little and Brown. Richard is a writer for The Nation and many, many other publications, and he's also the author of Booked, A Traveler's Guide to Literary Locations Around the World. Richard, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. Really appreciate it.
So could you talk about this incredibly timely book? Give us a quick overview, and what led you to decide to write this book?
Sure. So it's a history of the idea of breaking up the United States. From the very beginning, which, you know, is obviously an arguable date, but I go with a traditionalist, 1620, you know, the Mayflower, 400 years ago, right up to today. You know, how hard it was to form a union, how reluctant the colonists were to do so, why they were reluctant, how it came together as basically a means to an end, an accidental byproduct of this revolution. It almost immediately fell apart, was constantly prone to disunionist and separatist movements, obviously fell apart in this, you know, calamitous civil war, and wasn't really put back together, certainly not in any kind of, you know, truly united way. And, you know, through the 20th century, I'm tracing this idea of disunion and the idea of breaking it up, which is obviously on the margins at that point, but it never really went away. And here in the 21st century, we've had a kind of resurgence of secessionism in a way that we kind of consider joke or, you know, a fringe movement, but it's actually, you know, kind of unusual in at least recent American history. It suggests to me that this idea of whether we're really united, whether we want to be, has never gone away, and is kind of returning, possibly even, you know, with a vengeance. I think it's not impossible that we will see serious secessionist movements arise in the next 20 to 30 years.
Yeah. What led you to make the choice? I mean, you know, your initial book was obviously on a very different topic. What kind of led you to deciding to take on this really fascinating revisiting of American history?
Yeah, well, I'm glad I can actually mention this, because I'm not sure I have before, but that other book was like a side project that I started after I did this one. And I just kind of did it at night while watching television. It's just a, you know, kind of not my main gig. You know, this has been my every thought for 5 or 6 years now. So, you know, a lot of people, I think the book is a response to the Trump era or to the Trump moment, or, you know, if Biden wins, it'll kind of immediately be irrelevant. That's what, you know, what's his face? Rich Lowry at the National Review was kind enough to point out in the lead of his review of my book. That's really not the case. I mean, you know, it's a response to the Obama moment, if anything, where I was, you know, extremely frustrated, as the rest of us were, that control of the federal government and this presidency that had begun on such an optimistic note hadn't really gotten anywhere, that he hadn't been able to pass any legislation. So I started, you know, I was reading a lot about the Civil War at the time. I was the archivist for The Nation as they were preparing for their 150th anniversary issue. So I was reading a lot about Civil War Reconstruction. Then I kind of moved back in time to the Revolution. I was reading Charles Beard, I was reading Woody Holton, people like this. And eventually, you know, very important to me, David C. Hendrickson's Peace Pact, which argues that the Constitution was essentially a treaty meant to avert a civil war. And that was an incredibly provocative suggestion to me, and I thought I'd run with it and see how it applied to all of American history. You know, and then politically today, the question had arisen in my mind of whether the Union was the obstacle to, you know, progressive policies and programs that I wanted to see enacted. And perhaps, you know, in a smaller country, it would be a more democratic country, and certainly a less dysfunctional one. So I wanted to go throughout American history and see who else had that thought, for what reasons. I mean, we all know about the Confederacy, obviously, but I suspected that others had the idea of breaking up the Union for noble ends. And, you know, once I found the disunion abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison, and you know, briefly Frederick Douglass, arguing that point before the Civil War, you know, I was inspired to keep looking and track the entire idea of disunion from the beginning to what may or may not be the end.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, if Rich Lowry doesn't like your book, that's probably a good sign, right?
Oh, totally, yeah.
So that's the kind of negative review we all want. But
absolutely.
You know, but I think that it is, you know, we can get into this later maybe, but too, but the idea that everything here is being motivated by Trump, and that, you know, your book's a response to Trump, and other kinds of writings around these things are a response to Trump, you know, and I think on both kind of among a lot of liberals, certainly, but really across some of the, quite a bit of the spectrum, there is this kind of idea that Trump is this unique figure creating a unique kind of politics, and that you get rid of him and it, you know, things kind of go back to normal. But that seems unreasonably optimistic to me for the reasons that you discuss in terms of how you started thinking about this book and around, you know, the response to Obama.
Absolutely. You know, even if Biden takes the presidency, even if he takes the Senate, they need to abolish the filibuster. And even then, you need to convince Joe Manchin to sign on to everything. You know, I think the Senate, you know, this is skipping ahead quite a bit, but I think the Senate needs to be abolished. I think that's, I see that as basically the continuation of like colonial era divisions in the 21st century. You know, if we're looking for the source of disunion or the source of, say, the failures of democracy in the moment, we might look to these institutions that enshrine division in our constitutional system, and that that were intended to be anti-democratic and are. You know, a sort of key moment in my deciding to write the book was that I was reading about Charles Beard's theories about the Constitution in the New York Public Library, and this is late 2014, and I left, and I was walking down the street, and there's a Black Lives Matter protest, and somebody was holding a sign that said, "The system isn't broken, it's fixed." It was kind of this like moment of epiphany for me, because that's also what Beard was talking about, you know, about the Constitution. And it seemed to me that the reason why Occupy Wall Street failed, you know, the reason why we haven't been able to get anything passed is because the system is working as it was intended to in blocking those initiatives. And it's not malfunctioning.
Yeah. Well, let's start talking about some of that and the creation of the country, because it's long been my feeling, and I sort of teach it this way when I teach the first half of the American survey, that really the truly amazing thing about the United States is that it actually worked, sort of, right? That it actually stayed together, because there was no really good reason to think that it would. And, right. You know, and it was a mess, really, for most of the, you know, first half of the, or at least, you know, the first century of its existence. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people, you know, we understand the Civil War, we understand that kind of secession, and we can talk about that or not. But can you talk a little bit about the roots of this, and you know, to build on Charles Beard's view of the Constitution, the ways in which ideas of disunion threatened America at its very beginning, and how the nation avoided that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we often skip over the colonial era pretty quickly in surveys and in a lot of, you know, books about American history and national discussions, but there was 150 years there where the colonists did not form a union. You know, it took them absolutely forever to decide to do so. And I argue that that wasn't because they didn't think of it. It took them a while to even do that, because it just didn't make a lot of sense. But even when they did, when Benjamin Franklin proposed his Albany Plan of Union in 1754, it was rejected out of hand. The colonists wanted nothing to do with one another. You know, it didn't seem like a natural thing to do, to make a single nation out of these far-flung, disparate, very different colonies. And when they did so in the Revolution, it was, you know, a means to an end. It was the only way that they could successfully rebel against the crown. And so I think that there were doubts about American unity present from the beginning. You know, James Madison said during the Revolutionary War, the present union may not survive the present war. He didn't expect it to. A lot of them expected it to fall apart. And it very nearly did. You know, by 1786, you have Shays' Rebellion. You have secessionist movements in New England and in the West and in the South, in every part of the country, massive disagreements about the Mississippi River controversy, whether it was worth giving up to Spain the idea of, you know, American rights to trade on the Mississippi in exchange for commercial concessions, was this massive debate, you know, the first sectional dispute, basically. And then, of course, you know, I mentioned Shays' Rebellion, you had these huge class divisions, which the Constitution was an effort not to resolve or mediate, but you know, for total victory on the side of the wealthy. You know, you mentioned, you started off with that it's impressive that the country did, that it did work, that it did hold together. I'm not so sure, because what did that cost? You know, just to take one example, it cost the perpetuation and the support of slavery. You know, the compromises in the Constitution that buttressed slavery for decades. And the union persisted only on that basis. Without that, it would have fallen apart. And it's not like there was nobody at the time who objected to that. You know, I celebrate. There were certainly very few. I'm not trying to pretend it was more people than it was, but very few Northern anti-slavery, anti-federalists who argued against ratification of the Constitution because of the supports that it gave to slavery. So, you know, I don't know how pleased those people were that it did work, you know, so to speak. And, you know, there were, of course, it didn't break up for 80 years. That was a lot longer than, as you say, a lot of people expected that it would last. But there are plenty of movements or you know, projects to dissolve it. The Burr Conspiracy, the New England Separatist Movement of 1803, 1804, and then during the War of 1812. And certainly many moments where it very nearly could have broken apart. And that it didn't, you know, I'm not sure is owed to the you know, far-seeing wisdom of the founders in Philadelphia, you know.
Well, in terms of, you know, the Constitution itself and the creation of that in 1787, you know, you mentioned the role of class and, you know, that the kind of early class divisions of America, you know, fall in the sense of, you know, your kind of Eastern elite and your Western frontier farmer type. And then also between obviously your Southern slaveholder and your slave, you know, and it's more complicated than that, of course. But how does the Constitution, you know, what are the sacrifices that are really required in order to make a nation work around issues of class and race, and how, which maybe is kind of a convoluted way to ask, how does the Constitution put off disunion?
Well, I mean, there's two questions. There's the class question and there's the disunion question, which is kind of more of a sectionalism question. And there are ways in which those two phenomena overlapped and played into one another, but they were largely different. I mean, the main way in which the Constitution, you know, suppressed this brewing class revolt was through its prohibition on paper money. You know, in 1786, there was this huge movement, especially in Rhode Island and in other states, for paper money. To make it easier for these farmers, especially, to pay their taxes and also to pay off their debts, but mostly to pay their taxes, and you know there so we find in the Constitution a prohibition on paper money, and in other ways that the federal government took power from the states. You know, back then the states were more responsive to popular complaints than the federal government. So that was the main way it did that. How it put off a civil war. It reconciled the different elements. It gave the North, you know, the compromises that were made. Say, you know, we talked about the Senate. There's this massive debate going back to 1774 about representation, which essentially is a question of what is the Union? Is it supposed to be this kind of international assemblage of diplomats from these separate countries? Or is it going to be a unified nation? Are the people going to be represented or the states as sovereign entities? You know, and this question had divided the delegates and the revolutionaries from the very beginning, from the First Continental Congress. And the large state delegates had constantly been pushing to change the system from equal state suffrage to, you know, popular representation. And constantly saying that the Union would not work if it stayed with equal state suffrage. You know, so the Constitution, they finally won, obviously, except with the Senate. Does that answer your question? I feel like I got kind of lost there.
No, I think it's fine. I guess I'm just interested in, you know, there's such a veneration of the Constitution and the founders in ways that I think sometimes are not overly useful obscure a lot more than they clarify. And so if the Constitution maybe in the end was a kind of a reactionary document, you know, I'm wondering what that should, you know, reactionary document in order, I guess, to create a nation that did not really have, to use the political theorist Benedict Anderson's idea of an imagined community, that there's no imagined community in America right. In 1787, you know, what are the sacrifices required in order to sort of gerrymander a union together out of a bunch of totally disparate elements?
Yeah, I mean, different sacrifices in different places. You know, the South demanded, you know, just one thing that comes to mind, demanded a 2/3 vote for all restrictions on trade, you know, because free trade was extremely important to the South and to South Carolina, especially even then. But they give that up in exchange for, you know, the prolongation of the slave trade. So New England, you know, gets something and the South gets something. That's another sort of key bargain. A lot of people gave different things up. But, you know, what interests me basically is that it almost falls apart immediately. Within a year of the Constitution going into effect, there are people who are loudly, and people in prominent places in Congress itself, loudly questioning whether the trade-offs that they had made in Philadelphia to ratify the Constitution were worth it. You know, and immediately congressmen are kind of interviewing each other and asking each other, does this really make sense, or should we kind of agree to a national divorce and go our own way? Of course, it didn't happen, but to me, the fact that they were already considering, you know, giving up on it suggests something about the stability of what they had created.
Yeah, and I think that that's a good point, a good place to kind of move us forward in time a little bit, because I you know, in our popular understanding of secession, you know, it's really associated clearly with the South and in the Civil War, and you know, in a kind of modern liberal context, these are seen as traitors who did a very, very terrible thing and seceded for the worst possible cause. And obviously, I agree with that, but that secessionist language, as you point out, you know, if we just sort of put it on the South, we really ignore the contradictions in that, you know, the North was more than happy to use secessionist language when it served their interests, and so were different parts of the West. And, right. You know, so could you sort of fill in this story of, say, the early 19th century a little bit more in terms of our history of secession?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the more fascinating things I found, I think, is how the language of secession and nullification and states' rights passes back and forth from one part of the country to another, from one political party to another, depending on who's in power and you know, whose interests that language serves. So, you know, immediately the Federalists, of course, are in control under Washington and Adams, and the Republican Party, you know, develops under the leadership of Jefferson and Madison, and they, you know, of course, in this 1798 Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, come close to arguing for secession or certainly nullification. Jefferson wanted to go further than Madison. But as soon as Jefferson takes power, they completely switch. And Jefferson's insisting on a perpetual union. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. It's now the New England Federalists who are out of power, who are, you know, quite publicly and volubly entertaining the idea of seceding from the Union or maybe eventually rejoining Canada, Great Britain. This goes back and forth, you know, several times until, of course, the Federalist Party is kind of doomed to oblivion by the Hartford Convention, the ill-timed Hartford Convention of 1814-15, where they're threatening to secede from the Union. But their messenger gets to Washington, D.C. at the same time as news that the war is over and they've lost all their leverage. So they kind of look like fools. The idea is getting passed back and forth. And this goes on right up until the very eve of the Civil War. I depict the 1850s as a decade not when Southern separatism was on the rise, but Northern separatism and questions about the Union. And it wasn't only Garrison and Garrisonians at that time. It was also people who didn't really care about slavery. They just objected to the power that the South had amassed in Congress and its use of violence, you know, in Kansas and also, you know, in the caning of Charles Sumner, for instance, to get its way. So many ordinary Northerners were questioning the Union and arguing for secession or especially nullification within, you know, just a couple of years before Lincoln's election. I very briefly entertained this thought experiment of had the election been stolen from Lincoln by the House, the vote going and thrown into the House of Representatives, where Democrats had a majority. I mean, I think it's possible that the North would have, you know, at least threatened secession that winter rather than the South. And then you mentioned the West. I mean, that's also a very interesting story. A lot of people talk about, you know, California secession after Trump's election. But I don't think they quite realize that there's this very, you know, extensive and popular movement for California independence in the 1840s and in the 1850s. This idea that they were just on the other side of the continent, the world away. It took months to sail from New York to San Francisco, and it didn't really make sense for the far Pacific coast to be part of the United States. And this was a very popular idea. Thomas Jefferson even said in 1815, when John Jacob Astor established the first settlement on the mouth of the Columbia River in Oregon, he said, "Thank you, good job, but that's probably going to be a separate country. You know, I think, you know, there's no reason to think that the East and West will be part of the same republic. They'll be settled by, you know, white Anglo-Saxons, hopefully, but, you know, Americans, but it won't be the United States. Even Daniel Webster supported that, you know, liberty and union, one and inseparable. But he didn't really think so when it came to the West Coast. You know, he thought that a perfectly liberty-loving, you know, republic could be founded there that would not be part of the United States. And right up to the Civil War, you know, in that winter, after the Southern states secede, extremely prominent politicians in California, the governor, U.S. senator, and members of the Oregon congressional delegation are supporting the establishment of the Pacific Republic so that they don't have to get, you know, swept into this building war between the North and the South. You know, it suggests to me that things were far more open and you know, radically open-ended than we tend to remember them as.
Yeah. So to kind of move forward here, so we have about 10 minutes left, and I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the present. But after the Civil War, in the after Reconstruction, you have the compromise, you know, of 1877, ending Reconstruction. You know, there was that kind of threat of, again, disunion there. But after that, it seems like really conversations about disunion, they're sort of in the mix, but they significantly decline until maybe the 1960s, when you really pick back up a lot of secession. Why do you think there is a kind of lull in this secessionist history?
Good question. I think it's basically because the Union in the Compromise of 1877 and you know, the longer end of Reconstruction, you know, that took another 15 years or so, the Union was basically reconstructed on the basis of white supremacy and of the demands of the Confederacy, you know, with the actual institution of slavery, you know, notwithstanding. And so there was the South wasn't going to secede because they were basically getting the system that they wanted, which was racial apartheid and segregation. And the North, I think everyone was too traumatized by the Civil War and how much it took to enforce the Constitution in the South for just a few years to undertake it again. They weren't going to. So the Union is you know, fairly stable and strong, you know, as long as that system and those principles don't come under attack. Once they do in the civil rights movement, you know, American politics is disturbed in a way that we haven't yet recovered from. I do, you know, in that period, I try to show how it was lingering underneath the surface, you know, and how this idea of disunion had never actually really gone away. You know, the conquest of the Southwest after the Mexican-American War is the tenuousness of it is arguably what propels the United States into World War I and its you know, emergence as a world power and involved in European affairs with the Zimmerman telegram, which promises Mexico, you know, the return of the Southwest in exchange for entering the war. And you know, it's the interception of that finally convinces Wilson to join the war. You know, lingering doubts about how solid this union really is. And then, you know, I see the conservative reaction to the New Deal as a kind of lingering embers of separatism, of sectionalism. And I think that's essentially what creates modern conservatism is this you know, sectional, kind of quietly neo-Confederate opposition to federal power.
Well, and I think that moves us toward the present, right? That, you know, once the civil rights movement really gets underway and starts to have success, you have a revival of secession movements on, you know, among sort of Black Power and some of this, but also very heavily on the right. And, you know, to me at least, and I think to a lot of people, you know, the defining issue of modern American politics is still the reaction against civil rights. That's really what's happening here is the long sort of half a century slowly building outrage over the civil rights movement that is moving into a sort of full-fledged fascism today. And so, you know, whether you want to talk about the 60s more or the present, where do you see, you know, I guess to be more specific, where do you see us today in terms of this? Because there is so much division. And the division feels like a civil war kind of division. The era of compromise feels like it's over. What should we take out of this history for our politics today?
lots to tackle. You know, there are sectional tensions in the 60s and 70s and since. So, you know, they began to use, I show sort of about industrial, you know, about manufacturing fleeing northern states for southern and western states and how that played into things. But that's not really the story. You know, the story to me is the nationalization of southernism, of white southernism, you know, starting in the backlash to the civil rights movement. And George Wallace, you know, in his famous Segregation Now, Segregation Forever speech, says, you are Southerners too. You know, he's talking to New Englanders and other Northerners, Westerners. You are Southerners too. If you object to, you know, black equality and to, you know, the use of federal power to ensure it, you know, you're a Southerner too. You're an heir to the Confederacy. And that's when you start seeing Confederate flags, you know, up to the Canadian border. That's why the Confederate flag today is kind of almost has nothing to do with the South. You know, you see people flying it everywhere. So the division today is not really a regional one. It's everywhere. And, you know, I say that if the Union divides again, it won't be along one clean line like the Mason-Dixon. It'll be everywhere all at once. And I do think that this is a real threat today. You know, just bringing it to the present, I think there is a real risk of a, you know, severe constitutional breakdown. That this all seemed far more radical when I started this project like 5 or 6 years ago. I thought I'd have to do a lot more work trying to convince people that it really was as bad as all of this, and that the Union really was, you know, perhaps in jeopardy, or that we all should be calculating the value of the Union as Americans in the early Republic did. And I think many people have started to, you know, if Trump steals the election, I think that a lot of people are and should be talking about possible remedies. I mean, you use the F word, you know, fascism. I mean, if we're talking about the United States falling victim to fascism, I mean, it seems to me that this is a remedy, you know, possibly equal to the seriousness of that situation. Or even, you know, if he wins the election with 5 million, you know, but loses the popular vote by 5 million votes, but wins the Electoral College, I don't see why, you know, blue states should not issue an ultimatum and say, we need to abolish the Electoral College or we're not participating anymore in any more national elections. You know, it's not a fair playing field. So, you know, the book is, you know, 99% description and probably 1% prescription. But the 1% of that is I think that we need to think seriously about whether the Union is working today and what other alternatives might be.
Yeah. And I mean, to me, reading your book kind of reinforced some things I've been thinking, and that, you know, some of what we're facing today is a kind of a revisiting in some ways of the Compromise of 1877, that it's effectively the imposition, the reimposition of Jim Crow America, but on a national scale, and not only around race, but also around cultural issues, that, you know, that the same kind of increasingly organized violence by the right, just like there was during Reconstruction and in the imposition of Jim Crow to enforce a reactionary social order, except now it's being, you know, targeted against liberal professors, or it's being targeted against obviously black communities, but also, you know, white allies who are coming out and in support of Black Lives Matter. And, you know, the future is unknown. I don't know if you want to close with any predictions about where you see the nation in 10 or 15 years, or is that something that you want to, as a historian, I would back away from that, but you know, you may want to take that on.
I mean, I think a lot depends on what happens in, you know, in November, unfortunately. I mean, I think that if Trump wins re-election or somehow manages to hang on, I mean, my allegiance to, you know, this country as it currently exists is going to be seriously in jeopardy, to say the least. If Biden wins, I think it buys us some time, but there's still these deeper structural, institutional, constitutional questions and obstacles, I think, to doing what is absolutely necessary, say, passing climate change legislation, the Green New Deal, to not only keep the country together, but keep, you know, humanity existing. So we don't have that much time, you know. And you mentioned this kind of nationalization of Jim Crow. I mean, this raises a whole can of worms, but that's kind of what I think about when people say, well, what about, you know, Missouri, or what about Alabama if the country breaks apart? I mean, if they're making us all into, you know, the worst version of Missouri and Alabama, then I think there's nothing wrong with at least taking a look at the idea of carving out a part or some parts of the country that can maintain a modicum of humanity and you know, not to mention democracy.
Yeah. All right. Well, we should let you go. You know, your book is amazing, not exactly cheery, but those are the times in which we are in. So I've been interviewing Richard Kreitner, and his new book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, just came out last month, and I strongly recommend each LGM listener to buy it. Thank you, Richard.
Awesome. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,